No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and that affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-628-6001. Or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIO2. Maria, are you there?
Yes.
We're glad,
Michael.
Yeah, we're glad to have you back. Yes.
And it's good to be back since we had a hiatus with our esteemed professionals at BBS Radio and their amazing jaunt to Burning Man.
Yeah, what do you call that? You know, I think it was more partying than anything else. I mean, I don't want to cast any aspersions at our great. Maybe we can have them on at some point. Have Doug come on and tell us what it was like. I'm sure it was an amazing experience. But
I've actually interviewed several folks that have been there prior and post. One gal who's been, she was there again. She's been there and done installations, and she's in her mid-20s. She's gone at least like a half a dozen times. Apparently, it's somewhat transformational and life-altering.
Well, if there's anybody that needs to be transformed, it's that guy, Doug. So let's get him on the air later to talk about it. But and let's bring on our guests in a minute. But first,
yes,
let me give a shout-out to Representative Michael Capano and Seth Moulton, both Democrats from Massachusetts. Moulton is from Massachusetts 6th District, and Capano is from Massachusetts 7th, and they both signed on to the statehood bill this week, bringing the total of co-sponsors on our little bill to make the District of Columbia state 138, and that's the most we've ever had. So that's great.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for you, Michael.
The most we've ever had. So,
I'm so proud of you and your efforts.
Well, you know, I mean, there's so many people working on this, and yeah, it's great to see progress made. And, you know, we still got a ways to go, but, you know, step by step. And we have a special guest tonight, and our guest is Hector Rodriguez. Hector is an old buddy of mine. He's been involved in the movement for a long time. We met each other several years ago, and he's a stalwart in our effort to get statehood. But he's also many other things. He's a veteran he's a military veteran. He has lots of experience in issues that involve Latinos in government. He's from Puerto Rico, originally born in Puerto Rico, still has family there. So we want to talk to him about all that's going on with Puerto Rican statehood and the Dreamers and, of course, the terrible hurricane that's hit Puerto Rico. So let's bring him on. Hector,
yes.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. And thank you for bringing me on the show. And it's great to work with you and Maria Sanchez.
Yes, sir.
A pleasure.
And mine, well, and I think that Michael inadvertently called you old, and I don't believe he meant to do that.
No, he's not old. You know,
you said he's an old friend of mine.
Well, I always say it's not how many years you have, but what you have in your years, you know.
Yes, trips around the sun, right?
Yeah.
I only did that because Hector is a handsome devil with white hair who always says when he started in the statehood movement, his hair was black. So I like to point that out whenever I can.
That is true. That is true.
So then we can call you seasoned.
Seasoned.
Yes. Seasoned.
Yeah.
I am seasoned. That's true.
Well, Hector, let's start out by talking about Puerto Rico. I know you still have family there, and, you know, all that we're hearing right now is you know, bad news. Millions of people without power. The hurricane evidently hit them very, very hard. How are the people that you know doing?
Well, I've been talking to my cousin. He used to be mayor of a small town in the center of the island called Jajuya, which was named after a Taino Indian chief. Jajuya is the coffee area for Puerto Rico, and that's where I was born. We used to go swim in the rivers. It's more country. But one of the good things that Puerto Rico started after many, many experiences with hurricanes was to make the homes concrete. The government got into a program with people and assisted people in making concrete homes so that they could withstand, you know, the ravages of some of these storms. And so some of the places did better than many, many years ago. In Jajuya, they got a lot of strong winds and there was some infrastructure damage, but it wasn't serious. Puerto Rico was spared, really, you know, the strength of Irma this time around. They were spared this time around, and they got very strong winds and all that. My family is fine. Then I talked to my family near the center of the island, northeast actually, in Mayagüez and Ponce, and they're doing fine also, and they're out helping other people, which is, you know, part of the Rodriguez culture. So, you know, there are a lot of places without telephone communications. Some wiring is down, and they're trying to get people back into communications again. But there was extensive damage to the infrastructure, particularly the communications infrastructure.
Well, we're glad to hear that everybody's all right. Go ahead, Maria.
Yes, I wanted to ask, please share what you meant by with government assistance and the concrete, because I'm curious what that looks like.
Oh, yes. Many years ago, a brilliant governor, Luis Muñoz Marín, which was in the 50s to the 60s, after, you know, the hurricanes and people's homes being blown away, the government started a program. It's like a public-private sector kind of program where the government would invest in people's homes as they were building them to make sure that they could afford to pay for the concrete structure, the basic structure. And that has made a lot of difference, particularly in the countryside.
I bet.
And I love that private public partnership, if you will, right? Because it benefits all of us moving forward.
It benefits everyone, yes.
Insurance companies should be involved with that because it helps them too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, in fact, you know that you wouldn't be able to build a house on the coast of the Atlantic coast of the United States if it weren't for government-sponsored insurance. The premiums would be so high that you wouldn't be able to afford it. So for years, there's been a government. I only know this because I've ever had a beach house, but because I have friends that have beach houses, and the government is intimately involved in providing special insurance for people that have houses on the coast. So those partnerships are very, very important.
Well, you know, the agriculture. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, a little point here. You know that one of my cousins has a little coffee business, you know, a farm, And I was very concerned about her coffee crop because it's out now. And so I asked, what happened to the coffee? Is it going to survive? They said, we'll lose some. But the advantage is right now that the coffee beans are still green, so that they'll stick to the tree. If the coffee was ripe and ready to be picked, they would have lost all their crops. So they were saved in that respect. Just a little detail about the agricultural significance.
Well, as my dear old dad used to say, better to be lucky than good. And that's great. As a coffee drinker, you know, without coffee, I have to go have my blood drawn because I'm a diabetic once a month, and I have to be fasting to do it. And I go first thing, I'm the first appointment, because the idea of making it until 9 o'clock in the morning without a cup of coffee is more than I can stand. So
one of the most beautiful sights in Puerto Rico, in the coffee country, is when the coffee is ripe and the beans are all red, and you look and it's a panorama of color down and up those hills. Yeah.
Because we've got great in California that do that, but to think about coffee beans doing that, that sounds fantastic.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes.
Well, let's talk for a minute about statehood with Puerto Rico. You're an advocate. You've been an advocate for a long time with statehood here in Washington, D.C. And as most people probably know, Puerto Ricans are citizens of the United States. They have been for 100 years. They actually serve in the military higher than the national average. They're very patriotic people. And for years, they've tossed around the idea of, and thank you, Hector, for your service, because I know you're a former, you're Army, right?
Yeah.
In the Army.
Uh-huh.
Yes, a former veteran. And, you know, for years, they've toyed with the idea of statehood. They've had several initiatives, and most recently they passed a referendum for statehood and put together what is a very, very serious statehood delegation. They're sending a delegation to Washington, where the governor has appointed two former governors, a former leader of the Puerto Rican Senate, a retired general, And to top it all off, a Major League Baseball player who's in the Hall of Fame. He's a Hall of Famer. So this is serious biz. They're really getting down to it, and they're going to send this delegation. I'm not sure if they're here in Washington yet. We've reached out to the resident commissioner, but haven't heard back from him. Of course, very, very busy now with other things. But so what do you think about this newest effort for Puerto Rico?
Well, I think it's exciting. Ever since I was a kid, when we left Puerto Rico, there was always that question, you know, should Puerto Rico be part a state of the United States? Should it remain Commonwealth, or should be independence? It's a very interesting situation, because when we left Puerto Rico and I was a 7-year-old kid, the nationalists, the independents, attacked our city and burned the police station, and the National Guard was out there looking for them in the mountains. Now, about some 50 years later, my cousin is a mayor, and was mayor, and while he was looking for them as a National Guard as a young man, as a mayor, he was welcoming the nationalist leader, and there was a house dedicated to her, and so things have calmed down with that part. But Puerto Rico has been connected, as you said, over 116 years as an American territory, and then it got Puerto Ricans became citizens in 1917 with the Jones-Stratfort Act. So we've been American citizens since 1917, and people wonder, well, what is so significant about Puerto Rico? Why do they want Puerto Rico? Why did the United States want Puerto Rico? Strategically, Puerto Rico has been a very key military entree, first for the Spaniards, And then for the United States. And when there were no missiles, Puerto Rico basically had bases and military personnel and Air Force to protect the underbelly of the United States. And that underbelly is, you know, where the oil comes in from the Middle East, and all that had to be, and into Louisiana in those areas. And so all that had to be protected. So Puerto Rico was a very strategic find for the United States. The other thing is that, of course, as you mentioned, Mike, Puerto Ricans had served in the armed forces, and they distinguished themselves with many medals of honor, and have fought very bravely and courageously for our country. And let me say this to you. Right now, there are 40 million Puerto Ricans. 1 million live in the United States, and, of course, 3 million in Puerto Rico. The interesting thing is that about 28% of the registered Latino voters in the United States are Puerto Rican. And it's obvious because they're American citizens. So once they move here, they can register and they can and vote and participate in the presidential elections. And, of course, you both know and the audience that Puerto Rico right now cannot vote for president of the United States. But they do participate in the party's elections as far as the initial, you know, votes and all that kind of
right.
thing.
The primary. Right,
so,
primary.
So what my right. question is, if I may, because I've been yes. to Puerto Rico a couple of times and I loved it, and you close your eyes and open them and you think you're in the United States with all the signage
yes.
and the English and everything else. I was just there in at the end of April, and everyone uh-huh. that I mentioned this to Michael, I said, are you interested in becoming a member of the United States? And everyone, every single person, now granted I was meeting the working people, you know, the restaurateurs, the hotel workers, the cab
yes.
drivers, the Ubers, et cetera, they all 100% said no. And what mm-hmm. I'm curious about, though, is, as a citizen of the United States who was born in Texas and has lived in California all but 10 months of my life, I would welcome Puerto Rico. I don't know what is the problem. What's the bias? What's the prejudice? What's the hesitation on both
well,
sides?
Well, I think a broader sample might have to be, a survey might have to be done, because if you look at the referendums, there has been an increasing interest in statehood, and probably, you know, the financial situation is a challenge right now. And, for example, Puerto Rico cannot is prohibited from filing for bankruptcy, but other states can, but Puerto Rico is prohibited right now. So that is a plus for statehood for Puerto Rico. So in light of this financial situation, there is an interest in statehood more than one would think from the past. The other thing is that, you know, with the financial situation, there's a about a $12,000 per person per capita, on the debt, and so that would be one thing that they're interested in eliminating and getting more, you know, financial strength for the island. They would get, if they were a state, it also would increase the Social Security payments and the Medicare funding. You have a higher minimum wage than if you were a state, and also Medicaid funding and also disability benefits. Right now, with the debt crisis, is about $12,000 per capita, and then there's a 12.4% unemployment rate. So I think that's one factor. I think also in the near past, there has been more, interest in Puerto Rico from both parties, really, and because the Puerto Ricans that come here that can register to vote can make a difference. For example, if you take a look at Florida, you know, there's a huge number of Puerto Ricans that have moved there and can mm-hmm. determine you know, a state election now for senator and congressman too. So they have an impact in areas where they become a hub of population because they can vote. So that's an advantage that they have here. I think that the advantages for state, of course, are financial. There is a $70 billion debt crisis, as I mentioned. Some of the drawbacks, yes, that you were mentioning. If Puerto Rico becomes a state, they would have to, of course, pay federal income taxes on work performed in the states. Secondly, the federal income tax would be about $2.3 billion, according to the Government Accountability Office, and the federal corporate tax under statehood would be, I checked that it would be about $3.4 billion, so that many U.S. corporations would probably relocate and leave Puerto Rico, and that would be a loss of about 25,000 jobs to Puerto Rico and 50,000 indirect jobs, because there are companies that are getting, you know, tax advantages by settling in. I think that you know, a broad survey has to be done of the Puerto Rican people, and I think the elections or the referendums have been kind of a test, but there have been problems with, I think that Mike, the 2012 referendum, the questions that were asked, and this last referendum in 2017. 97% of the voters voted for statehood, but there was only 23% of voter turnout.
Right.
So,
Michael,
you know, they disregarded that. But, yeah, so, but the fact is that, you know, Puerto Rico, with its 3 million population, is larger than 21 states.
Well, and you know what? I mean, I have a sister-in-law who's Puerto Rican. And I think almost all of Katina's family, her mom, her brother, all these people still live in Puerto Rico. And her opinion has always been, no, they'll never go for it because of the taxes, because of the federal tax thing. And I think that's been used by the opposition. You know, I think it's a bigger, they make a bigger thing out of it than it really is. I think it's been used by the opposition. And, you know, we always use that, right? I was a consultant to the Mondale campaign, and I remember everybody saying to Walter Mondale, don't say you're going to raise taxes. And what did he do? Mm-hmm. He went out and he said, I got to be honest with you. We're going to have to raise taxes. No, you know, nobody wants more taxes. We all know that. So that's important.
But you know what, Mike, you're right. But I think that, you know, but there are some advantages that can, you know, they can level off a little bit those taxes because, first of all, if Puerto Rico became a state, I believe they would get, they would get a $6 billion federal payment a year, you know, so that... you know, that's one tax benefit, you know, to help the state, you know, all states get, you know, federal payments. So Puerto Rico would get about a $6 billion federal payment, which would help to balance that out. And the other thing is, I think that, you know, there would be more opportunities for creative economic development and job producing. I think that the corporations that are there, in a way, they blindside the people because they depend on these corporations with these tax benefits. But then when there's the Congress backs out, then they leave. So it leaves people a little bit uncertain. I think there's a good relationship with the United States because people have served in the armed forces. And, you know, 1 million Puerto Ricans live here. And there's always that, you know, cultural batteries are, you know, Chris, there's, you know, opportunities for better exchange between both Puerto Rico and the United States mainland. Interesting that the United Nations considers Puerto Rico kind of a Caribbean nation. And to me, what I find interesting, though, is that both parties, both the Republican and Democratic Party, support Puerto Rico's right to apply for statehood. They feel that they should have a chance to express what their interest is, and that's a positive sign.
Yeah, and no offense meant here, Maria, but I think the Republicans have always been more interested in Puerto Rican statehood than in the district statehood, because they hate to see all that tourist money that they can't tax. You know, they don't get to tax. They don't get to tax all those lovely tourists that are going down to Puerto Rico. So the Republicans actually have it part of their platform. You know, they've been very supportive. And Puerto Rico, my understanding is they're just putting in a bill, and they have several Republican co-sponsors, where we have 138 Democrats, but not one Republican. So they have bipartisan support for statehood,
which
too.
Which means to me that it sounds like it's feasible.
Yes.
Maria, it is. I agree with you. It's feasible because, first of all, both parties do not, you know, they accept Puerto Rico's right to go for it, you know. And actually, it's the Republican Party the new Progressive Party that has a push for statehood for Puerto Rico, and organizer of the Jose Celso Barbosa was the founder of statehood, of the statehood movement in Puerto Rico, and also he founded the Republican Party of Puerto Rico. And then you have such luminaries, you know, like Luis Ferre, who was former governor, and Carlos Barceló, who served from 77 to 85, and Rosello's father was former governor. And like Mike said, there's a whole group of very high-ranking and well-recognized leaders that are recognized here in the United States that are leading this statehood effort. So, you know, it looks like it might gain some currency with the citizen at large, and I would say that the economic situation also buttresses that kind of interest.
Well, oh,
and
my
how do
God,
you feel
they
about
have a. I'm sorry, Maria. They have a National League Baseball Player Hall of Famer. Strauss and I couldn't put together a bowling team. So that's some real competition there, a Hall of Famer. I'm sorry, Marie. Go ahead.
Well, because what it sounds to me is like it's like they've gotten their A league or their A team together, and that's how serious they're taking this.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I would, you know, it's interesting in my household, my cousin stayed back in Puerto Rico. So I had two cousins that in the same family that were at it. One was more for independence, and then the other one was more Republican and conservative in his approach. He became mayor. Over the years, though, you know, my cousin who was for independence has softened as he has aged and sees, you know, the importance of considering statehood for Puerto Rico. I'm anxious to call him after this chat to see where he stands now. But I think he has softened on it, and I think that he sees, you know, as he matures, the need for, a very creative balance in the relationship between Puerto Rico and the U.S. And I think that a lot of Puerto Ricans here would support statehood for Puerto Rico.
Well, you know, one thing that should be pointed out too, Hector, which you mentioned briefly, is the separatist movement. It's very deep. You know, I don't know how prevalent it is in Puerto Rico, but it goes way back. You know, in 19, people may not remember, but it was Puerto Rican separatists that attacked the Capitol in the 1950s, and I believe there were several injuries and a death associated with that. They were very, very serious about, you know, that's a very serious element historically of the movement. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, they were very adamant about it. And I think, you know, I think that obviously, you know, one of the things that that they feared was, you know, that the culture would be whitewashed, if I may. And so they were very culturally engaged with their position. The language is of course part of the culture. You know, they didn't want to lose that language. And you know, so but these are people that felt very strong about it. Now, in the last referendum, the independents, they represent the Independence Party, got 5.4% of the vote, or some 70,000. I think it was 70,000. That represents about 70,000 of the vote. But 51% voted in for statehood. And what's interesting about this situation, Maria and Mike, is that 54%, let me see, I think it was, yeah, 54% rejected the current status, you know, the current colonial, if I may, status. So that's the key moving force, that the current status is not favorable to 54% of the people. One of the arguments against statehood, though, is that there has been a failure to express unequivocally, you know, the desire to become a state as opposed to some other alternative to the current territorial status. So that is a challenge. And then some people think, well, the language and cultural differences. But, you know, America is a multicultural country. And,
well,
and look at
and
all the
I
other states that,
that
came in,
Hector.
Hawaii and Alaska and all that, Texas,
yeah, but
you know.
Hector, I can speak to that because my mother is born and raised in New Mexico, and that state is the only one that has two languages that are sanctioned.
There you go.
So we have a precursor, if you will, to, and I would hope and insist that Puerto Rico would do the same thing.
Yes,
well,
you know,
yes.
We have two languages.
Yes.
And now that you brought it up, Maria, New Mexico waited 70 years for statehood. They're
wow.
one of the longest. They're one of the longest suffering. I mean, D.C.'s got everybody beat with 215 years, but they waited 70 years for statehood after they applied. And you know, it's often brought up that they became a state when they had a majority white population.
Right.
When
right.
Before well, that was the holdup for 70 years.
Yeah, you know the. It's interesting that the Puerto Rican people have actually developed a working relationship with America. I mean, right now they're coming in droves because of the economic situation, you know, and they're moving to Orlando, which we have about 200,000 people over there that can vote. And
wow.
So, you know, that economic situation is impacting the island. But part of that economic situation, you know, is because of the status, the current status. You know, it's dysfunctional economically. You know, you can't trade with another country. You have to, you know, there's stuff like that. One of the things that I've looked at, and I was just in Puerto Rico about, you know, maybe a month and a half ago, is, you know, I like to see more productivity in the island. I like to see Puerto Ricans own more of the facilities of production and all that. And I think with statehood, we'll be able to work on that. And I truly believe that Puerto Ricans from here can assist Puerto Rico into its statehood once it becomes a state. I think there's a lot of talent here that can serve in its legislature and vice versa. So I see a bright future for Puerto Rico becoming a state. I really do. And, of course, my hometown, D.C.
Well, there you go. And you know, even though, to be absolutely honest about it, Hector and I have traded opinions on this subject in the past, but we know that very often states come in together. They come in together. This has been the history of statehood in America, Alaska and Hawaii, for example. And, yeah. and you can go back all the way to the Missouri Compromise. States came in together. They came in together. We had a thing called the D.C. Voting Rights Act, which was an attempt to bring Utah and D.C. together for an extra vote on that right. basis. And, you know, and we've been reaching out to the resident commissioner because you know, certainly there's a lot to be gained by the two of us, the two communities working together towards statehood. So it's an exciting prospect. It's an exciting prospect for all of us.
It's exciting. And it, I think you mentioned that there's a couple of Republicans that are supporting Puerto Rico statehood. So maybe they can also give us a hand over here in D.C.
Yeah. I
well,
would think so.
Wouldn't that be nice? That would be me, by the way.
That would be you. You're willing to vote for statehood? Well, good. Because if, you know, if Maria says it should happen, it should happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, Hector, the thing you say about Puerto Ricans coming to the United States because of economic opportunity, this is why all people have come to the United States, right? I mean, this is why the Irish came, and my mother's family was Italian. This is why they came. I don't know how it is that we get over in this country for a while, and then we think that, that our ancestors were landed gentry that just decided that they wanted to leave, you know, and see someplace new. They were people that were starving in Europe, and they came here for more opportunity. So that is the segue to really what I consider a much more distressing thing personally, and that is what's happening with the group we call Dreamers in America. What do you think about the latest thing that's been done? You know, I think to call these people Dreamers is the perfect thing to call them, because that's what the American dream is. It's about making a better life for your family. So what do you think about this idea that we should be sending these children who have done nothing wrong back to a country that they don't even know anymore, maybe never even knew? What do you think about that, Hector?
A long time ago, when I was in the military, I wrote a paper, and I don't want to toot my horn, but I did receive a medal from the Freedom Foundation of America. And I wrote a paper called Defending Freedom Safeguards America. And so the aspirations, the faith, and the struggle, and very achievement of these young Dreamers, as you said, Mike, it reflects the most authentic spirit of our freedom in America. It's this very dynamic process which generates our unique socioeconomic vitality and success for our country. To envision and dream is vital, and in fact, the very substance of our American nation, you know. You know, and to discard, you know, the equality and justice that comes with freedom and these values is to invalidate our moral high ground. And it actually very threatens the very foundation of our security, because this nation stands upon freedom, and without freedom, we cannot stand. America cannot be safeguarded. So what these kids represent, you know, is a very, very special a view for us, again, when America is threatened and we have enemies out there, and here's these young kids who want to do things in America and for America. Do you know that there are 900 Stan? 900 Dreamers are in the military. You know, they have put up businesses, they have started families. The Dreamers are an incredible economic resource for our country. This is not just simply about having, you know, human empathy. This is also about, you know, a very practical and savvy situation for us to support these people. I mean, you have, you know, Dreamers that are employing people. Now, they have businesses, and there's some data, I don't have it with me, that shows you how many own businesses. And for one thing, though, you know, they serve to work on our farms. They're high tech people as well. They're versatile people, young people that help our country. And we would have, I read recently that there would be a $60 billion loss in tax revenues to the federal government if these young people are sent out. And there's another $280 billion, in the fight on our economic growth over the next 10 years. And Ike Brannon, I read this, Ike Brannon from the respected Cato Institute, put the study out about our economic loss as well. And these kids fill jobs. They fill military positions. And they are educating other people now. And so this is just, the decision by the president is not a very morally enlightened decision, but it is also an economic a wrong economic decision as well. So I go at it from both sides.
Well, and I agree with you. You know, now my mother, I consider myself a typical American because my father's family had been in this country for almost 200 years. But my mother's family, my mother was the first member of her family born in the United States. Both of her parents came from Italy. And it was, we were told all the time to work hard and that we had been given so much advantage that my grandparents didn't have growing up, and what a great country this was. I dropped out of high school when I was a teenager because I had a lot of problems in life. Both my parents died when I was 15, and I acted out, and I dropped out. And I've often been asked why I went back to school and ended up with a master's degree. And it's because that's what was expected of me in my family. If I had told my grandmother that I had figured out a way to make $1 million, the first thing she would have said to me was, "Great, now you can go back to school and get an education." Because that's what these people believed in. They believed in hard work, and they believed in moving ahead, and that is the American dream. And I agree with you 100%, Hector. It's not only economically foolish, but it's foolish for our security, and it really strikes at the heart of what America's about. That's what I believe.
Absolutely. America evolves, in a sense, as a worthy nation, as our people are free to explore and develop to achieve our dreams. We must continue to encourage, inspire, and support our young people to keep the American dream alive. And that's what these kids are doing. Because I think that we have gone to sleep. We don't realize, we have forgotten how special freedom is and to be able to dream. At one time my mother could not read or write, but I taught her how to read and write. And my mother worked in a hospital cleaning bedpans so that I could study in college.
Right.
And because she could read or write, and I became, a college graduate, and then I became a captain in the military, and she was very proud of that. But she deserved a lot of the credit because she's the one that sweated and worked very hard. And there's a lot of people that are supporting these kids, and I think that I hear that some of the Republican leaders are appalled at President Trump for rescinding having his this program rescinded.
Right. I am.
Well, and it's not over. Yes, you know what? Maria is my favorite Republican, and that's saying something because I have some. I have members of my family that are Republicans.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's not over yet. And I think that if I were speaking directly to the dreamers, I would say have hope and continue to dream, because there are a lot of people that support their effort in this country. And it really is what America's about. And we've given so many opportunities to so many people in the world. And we need to continue to do that, to be this country that we've always been, that we're all proud of. I know you're proud to be an American, Hector, and I know you're proud to be an American, Maria, and I'm proud to be an American, and we need to keep that
pride. You know, I wrote a song recently called I Still Love You, America.
Sing it for us.
But basically, the first stanza says, I still love you, America. Let's see. I still love you, America, for the promise you made me. I still love you, America, for you promised liberty. I still love you, America, for the promise that you made. I still love you, America, for the price that you have paid. That's one of the stanzas. Yeah. And that's what America
that's
to me.
That's absolutely true.
It's true, and, you know.
We have dot-commers that are immigrants that have changed the way that we live our lives with their social media creations. Google, I believe, is case in point. So we've seen the best and the brightest minds come here and help change the world, not just the United States of America.
Excellent.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
so
right.
There's no reason. I keep saying that sane minds will prevail. We have three branches of government. There are checks and balances. We do not have a monarchy. This is a democracy. And as wild and aberrant as that man is, who happens to be in the White House at the moment, I don't believe that just what he wants to do is going to be done.
Well, I agree. And, you know, and I think that in America, we're having some hard economic times right now. And this is really the lowest common denominator in politics. It always goes back to this. We see movements where people are isolationist and become nationalists during times of hard economic times. And we see that throughout our history. This is really nothing new. And every time, as you so eloquently put it, Maria, cooler minds have prevailed, and we've come out of these crises, and I believe that we'll do it again. I truly do.
I do, too. I have faith in our country. I have faith in our elected officials. I have faith in the system. I have faith in our forefathers. We've got an amazing legacy. I don't believe that one man is going to change all of that.
No, I don't either. So, Hector,
the American people, I believe, have a collective love, you know, for freedom and what it stands for. And I'm beginning to see that, both parties are beginning to look at the issues now, which is, I hope, you know, what we do. And I know they're going to support DACA. I know that Congressman Ryan is supportive. McConnell is not. So you have, you know, different points of view in the parties. But I think overall, I think that that the country is going to do something very special for these kids, and at the same time redeem itself, keep its own promise. And so, by the way, I want to announce today when we were talking about, I forgot to mention when we were talking about statehood, Mike, that I have announced American Veterans for D.C. Statehood. I forgot to mention it on our previous subject, but we've got 20 veterans that represent different organizations, and I felt it's time now to get the veterans engaged in an organized way, and we're making it a national movement to get the veterans around the country to fall in ranks with us. And we had one meeting already with Republican members of Congress. We were very well received, and we have started the dialogue, our organization, with the Republican members of Congress as veterans. Because one thing that the Republicans do honor is our veterans, and we think that is one way that we can approach, you know, the Republicans in a very fundamental and friendly way.
Well, you know what, Hector? I think that's essentially important for them to never forget the veterans from the District of Columbia. And surely every time we've gone up on the Hill with veterans, you're right, they're absolutely well received by both parties, as they should be. They should be respected for their service. And something that kills me about D.C. is that we have over 30 Congressional Medal of Honor recipients from the District of Columbia. The man that wrote the national anthem, Francis Scott Key, was a militiaman on assignment for the District of Columbia. And the guy that wrote Taps was a general, a Civil War general named Butterfield, who was also from D.C. So every time we put the flag up and every time we take the flag down, there's a Washingtonian involved. But when the flag flies high, they forget about us. So I think
our
it's
veterans,
really important
our veterans
to have that.
Are going to, you know, in that group, by the way, is a woman veteran who has a Purple Heart. Okay? She got wounded in combat, in a combat area, and she's got a Purple Heart. I'm going to be doing a feature on her.
Well, good. Nice. Well, we'll have to have, yes. And we're running out of time here, so we'll have to say goodbye to you, Hector, and thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being on the show. And any last words that you have, Hector, anything else you want to add?
Well, I want to definitely, express my praises to you, because you have taken very small resources and have created something. You see, it's not the position you have, it's what you do with it. And what you have done, Mike, with a limited resource, you've created a radio show, and I believe you have an education show in the schools also to teach people about statehood. So, you know, my hat off to you, because I know that you're maximizing whatever is put before you for our political freedom. And Maria, it's really wonderful to be talking to a fellow American, a Republican. I respect your positions as Republicans. Give us a little help with statehood, okay?
Absolutely. Michael knows that. I'll do whatever I can. Absolutely.
Right. I thank you so much.
Thank
and
you,
thank
Hector.
You.
Thanks for being on the show. And if, if it was up to Maria Sanchez, we'd already be a state.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
You're welcome.
You're very inspiring.
Anything you want to say, Maria, before we leave?
Well, just to that one person does make a difference. So everyone contributes to progress or to any kind of movement or gain or social awareness or what have you. And I think Hector is the perfect example of that, as are you, Michael. And we should empower people that you do matter. You are important. One of my adages is one voice, one vote, one paycheck. What we say, how we vote, and how we spend our money makes a difference. And so get behind the movement and lobby your Congress members and et cetera. Do you care where they are on the spectrum, Michael, in terms of Congress or Senate?
No, I mean, we want you all to go to www.statehoodnow.org and sign the petition. Sign the petition for statehood for the district, www.statehoodnow.org. We need to put pressure on these guys. But I can't say it any better than you just did, Maria. So thank you. And, you know, the last thing that I want to say is that our prayers go out to the people of Miami, the people of Southern Florida, all those people from your home state of Texas who have been so ravaged by these storms. Keep them in your prayers, America. And we're going to leave you tonight with a psalm by Creedence Clearwater, Who'll Stop the Rain? Let's all pray that it stops soon and that we can get back to being the greatest country in the world.
Yes. Well said, Michael. Thank you. Have a great week, everyone, and thank you for your time.
Clouds of mystery forest.
representation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to